This is the Education Gadfly Show.
Isn't it fun to have Rick back?
So much fun.
Oof, it's like old times. Yeah.
He hasn't said anything, though, sexist or racist or anything yet.
I
so
know,
maybe
he's
you can
not warmed
prod
up
him.
Yet.
I'm an older, wiser person.
More circumspect.
Oh,
very good.
Now, here's your host, Mike Petrilli.
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. And now, please join me. I'm so giddy in welcoming my co-host, the Elon Musk of education policy, Rick Hess.
Yo, Mikey. How you doing, Beb?
Rick Hess. I've not gotten to say those words in so long, that name. We have missed you, my friend.
It's good to be here with you, pal.
Back on the show. After a whirlwind worldwide tour, to hawk your book.
Yes, to St. Louis and Savannah and rural Connecticut, all kinds of places.
Yeah. Cage busting.
Cage busting, baby.
Have you met cage busting leaders?
You know, it's funny. Everybody who comes up to you at one of these conferences, principal, superintendent, board member, is a cage buster.
Yeah.
But they are surrounded by people who are not.
Yes.
So if you actually do the Venn diagram, it gets really interesting really quick.
One thing we'll have to talk about later is Tony Bennett, cage buster? I mean, you could argue he's the ultimate cage buster. And yet, what happened? He got busted right out of that job. Yep. That is an interesting lesson here. So Elon Musk, the Hyperloop, some kind of tube he's going to shoot people through between LA and San Francisco.
You know, it's like those water parks, man. Nothing like shooting through a tube, like Wet n Wild.
Yeah.
Summer Day.
Yeah.
I'm a huge fan. In fact, we saw the way, way back the other day.
Uh-huh.
The kid actually passed Sam Rockwell in the tube because he must have gone up the wall. And it was like kind of
cool.
I don't want to give away too much excitement from the movie, but a great movie.
Excellent. You know, my impression, granted, I don't live in California. I'm a long way from California. My sense is that there are a lot of problems in California to be solved. And I'm not sure, you know, getting people from LA to San Francisco in a half an hour or less is near the top of the list.
Might give them a lot of time to focus on the other stuff, though.
Hmm.
More to the point. They've already solved the education troubles because now they let the State Board of Ed deal with one set of districts operating one set of federal laws,
mm-hmm.
and another 1,000 districts operating under another set of federal laws. Well, what else could you ask
it's
for?
It's complete chaos out there. It doesn't matter. They're going to all get wiped out in the earthquake anyways. All right. So, hey, no offense to our California people. I'm not wishing for it. I'm just saying it's just geologically likely.
How likely is this?
I don't know.
I haven't heard it be described as likely since like 1979 or something.
Earthquakes, global warming. Come on, California's toast. Okay, we got lots to cover this week for the other 49 states and for our listeners around the world and for you people in California too. I'm just joking. All right, Pamela, let's play Pardon the Gadfly.
In this week's Education Gadfly, Mike argues that proficiency rates are not good measures of school effectiveness. What are your thoughts?
I mean, this is like the most obvious point ever, right, Rick?
Mike is correct. Well done, Mike.
Thanks. We've only been saying this for like 15 years.
The funny thing is, of course, I remember the pain on Mike's face back in like 2003, 2004, when he had to explain why proficiency was actually a good measuring stick for schools. Even then, I thought he knew better.
I probably did. But, I did. I was a loyal soldier then. Look, here's the deal, though, Rick. Still, in federal policy, in state policy, most of the time when we're judging schools, including for high-stakes decisions like which schools should be subject to the SIG program or have to be closed down or get a big fat F, most of the time we're still using proficiency rates. We're not using individual student growth over time. What is up with that?
That's a darn good question. You know what it is? It's you walk out of the bar at night and you see the drunk guy crawling around on the street under the street light. And you ask him what he's doing, and he says he's looking for his keys.
Right, right.
And you ask him, did you drop his keys there? He goes, no, I dropped them at the other end of the lane. And you go, well, how come you're not looking there? He goes, because this is where the street light is. What we do
Did you use that shtick in your talk?
Probably.
Ugh, Rick, come on. You don't say Einstein says the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again.
No, although I did use it in the title of the book. So
that's true. You did, Rick. It's Rick Cliché. Yes.
I like cliché. There's a reason clichés are clichés.
You like clichés. I like alliteration. This explains everything.
It all fits. But look, I mean, that's the deal, right? People have something they know how to measure, so they run around measuring the hell. It's kind of like economists.
I know, but we now have the ability to measure growth over time.
For a much more limited number of grades.
Right. I guess that's true for limited grades.
And you've got high mobility problems for a lot of these schools that we're concerned about.
Yeah.
So if you've got 30, 40% mobility or higher,
yep.
you wind up with you know, you can do five grade levels of value added for 65-70% of the kids. It's kind of a problem.
Look, this is coming up because the New York test scores came out last week, right? And Politico reported, Stephanie Simon at Politico reported that some of the charter schools in New York that are brand name charter schools did very poorly on proficiency rates. Democracy Prep, only 6% of its sixth graders were proficient in math or reading. I forget which one. Well, guess what? It starts in sixth grade. Okay, those kids have just entered the school 7 or 8 months previously. So all that is showing is that, wow, they're getting kids who are starting pretty far behind. Not very many people at grade level. By the time they get to the eighth grade, still only 30% of students are proficient. Well, against this very high standard. And what we don't know...
Well, high standard, or it shows that the test is measuring stuff the teachers aren't teaching.
Well, that's possible. And that's what a lot of people have been saying. Oh, these charter schools were teaching to the test. That may be. But look, I don't buy it. Because if you look at other studies of, say, Democracy Prep, what they can show you is making huge value-added gains over time. But we're not measuring that for these high-stakes accountability
systems. But I wasn't even actually making that point particularly about charters. I mean, right, this is kind of the broader Dan Coretz point, that people learn what domains are getting assessed. They learn which questions are getting asked. And frankly, I mean, Coretz, I think, you know, I suspect he would argue that you routinely see drops of 30% when you swap out one set of assessments for another.
Right.
So, I mean, I think part of my problem here is the notion that this clearly shows that these assessments are harder or more honest or giving people a more accurate read. It might just be that, you know, that when you tell people, aim for this target, and then you say, nah, we're moving the target 30 feet to the left, people are more likely to miss, no matter what else is going on.
Look, I am very worried that we have been labeling schools as failures that may be actually doing a great job. And that if you just looked at proficiency rates, you'd say Democracy Prep deserves an F. It should close. But it's actually had some rigorous studies done of it that show incredible gains. It's one of the best charter schools in the country. So these kinds of issues, pretty important.
But what happens if you see big gains and then on an assessment, you still don't actually see kids performing at a high level? How do you wrestle with this, Mike?
I think you wrestle with it by saying that the gains are what matter. If the kids are making huge gains over time, that is all we can expect from a school. You know, if kids are coming in four grade levels behind and making a year and a half of progress every year, we should celebrate that school, not close it down.
We're on the same page. I wrote this in a Common Sense School Reform back in the day, right? I said, look, if you work for the World Health Organization and you're delivering babies in Germany and you're delivering babies in, you know, a much tougher climb, the real comparison is where your kids are doing better, not the absolute birth weight.
Oh, yeah. I remember that. Page 281.
Yeah, look at you.
Sure, I read that book. Okay.
We're on the same page,
baby.
Topic
number two.
Several news outlets reported this week that the shine might be off Jeb Bush's education apple, thanks to the Tony Bennett grading scandal and conservative pushback against the Common Core. Rick says this might be his Romney care. Mike, is that true?
Look, I think in our little education bubble, we think that Common Core might be his Romney care. But I don't think at the end of the day, Common Core is going to matter a whole lot compared to big issues like immigration reform. I mean, you know, the degree that Jeb Bush has committed political suicide by becoming too moderate, it's much more, he's taking much bigger risks, I think, on immigration than he has in education. Look, there's no doubt that the Common Core stuff has hurt him and that he has spent some real political capital being one of the only Republicans out there saying good things about the Common Core. But you know, don't you think, Rick, that that pales in comparison to what the base cares about on immigration?
No. I think, you know, I think a number of the candidates who you're looking at maybe running in 2016 are around where Bush is on immigration. Certainly Rubio's out there with him. Chris Christie isn't going to get to his right on it. Rand Paul's not clearly going to get to his right on immigration. On the other hand, on Common Core, I mean, it seems to me this is an interesting case where, you know, Jeb has been, you know, the stalwart of the party. I mean, driving conservative school reform for 15 years. I think the Romney care analogy for me is that, you know, Romney got a lot of credit for getting out front on health care reform, showing Republicans could solve the problem.
Mm-hmm.
Jeb got out front from the first day in Florida, especially in 99, showed that Republicans could solve the stuff at the state level. Everybody always knew this was going to be one of his real strengths in both primary and general. Now, all of a sudden, I mean, I think there's lots of people outside the bubble who are going to, you know, make, you know, who are going to have a real problem with Jeb simply because they see him as being wrong on the Common Core.
Hmm. Well, we shall see. Like it matters. I mean, everybody's just handing it to Hillary anyways. Mm. Seems like, I mean, most of the press is aside. She's got it. It's locked up. We might as well just, you know, go to sleep for the next 3 years because wake up and we're going to have President Clinton.
Although we also read that same story in 06.
Oh,
so.
Right. We did. Good point. Topic number three.
Philadelphia Superintendent William Height has issued an ultimatum. If the school district does not receive at least $50 million in funding to close its budget shortfall by Friday, August 16th, the schools might not open in time. Is he right, or does Philly need to learn to stretch the school dollar?
What's going on here in Philly, Rick? I mean, is this just politics? People are doing this brinksmanship to try to get the state to pony up or the city to pony up? Or is this district actually going to fall apart?
I think it's probably a little of each. I mean, we know Bill Height. I like him, respect him.
Is he a cage buster?
I think he's got, you know, what I always say is that it's kind of like Catholics with sin and sinners, that rather than kind of talk about who is, it's that there are cage busting behaviors. And Bill's certainly got some of them. Because the problem is everybody's got a little bit of cage busting them, and everybody's got stuff that's something else. It's just the way of the world.
Okay.
But look, I think Philly is absolutely in a debacle. It's like going in as superintendent of Detroit a couple years back. I think you really are kind of stretched so thin that it's probably hard to make kind of all the benefit payments and those obligations. At the same time, I think the politics are so dense that it's a heck of a lot easier to ask for more money than it actually is to go in there with a hatchet and really go after some of these programs and, you know, and programmed expenses.
Yeah, I mean, look, it has certainly been a tough summer when you hear about what's happening in many of these big cities. I mean, Chicago laying off another 1,000 teachers. You know, Philly, it sounds pretty bleak. They've laid off a bunch of aides already. Now, look, I mean, laying off teacher aides, maybe not such a bad thing. We've been saying for years as reformers that those positions might hurt more than they help. But I guess the story that doesn't get reported is, you know, if the hatchet falls, are they going to be able to have it be surgical strike, right? Mm-hmm. Can they remove the ineffective teachers? Can they remove the positions that perhaps are the lowest value added?
And frankly, you know, I mean, my attitude is that, you know, that just trying to weed out the least effective educators, weed out probably isn't going to get you enough money the money that you need anyway.
Yeah.
I mean, the real surgical strike is to go after overall benefit obligations, healthcare,
right,
retirement, where politicos made promises they never should have and can't afford.
Yep.
And frankly, that's totally out of Height's grasp.
Well, some of it, I don't know. I guess it depends on the state. And Amber can tell me, you know, in Philly, could he come in and say, you know what, we're just no longer going to provide retiree health care insurance?
Well, sure, within the contract. So I don't know when the Philly contract is up. Yeah. But what you can't go back is you can't go back and simply, fail to live up to
previous
obligations.
But I guess the point I'm making is the pension stuff is tough because it's usually constitutionally protected. It's a state level thing in most places. The retiree health care is an area where there usually is more flexibility. That is not constitutionally protected. That is one of these benefits that you hardly ever see anymore in the mm-hmm. private sector. It's to say, we're going to pay the health care for retired teachers between the ages of, say, 55 and 65.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that you can make a case that says, look, those people, they may be done teaching, but they should be out there working and can get benefits someplace else.
And frankly, and this is where the politics of this becomes determinative, that it's a huge, right? This is what we've, you know, New York City, right? 40% of the folks who actually vote in the UFT elections are teachers. 60% are retirees or paras.
Yeah.
So they've got every incentive to stand firm. They don't care all that much about impacts on current practitioners. Same is true in many of these systems. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, if you're Bill Height, you're going to get torn apart in the papers if you're trying to take away benefits from hardworking employees, and nobody's going to rally to your defense. The key thing here is that either the Detroit bankruptcy model
mm-hmm.
or what Walker did in Wisconsin or what they did in Indiana or Tennessee to narrow collective bargaining and start to free folks up to deal with this stuff is where you actually create room to go ahead and revisit some of these bad deals folks have made.
All right, let me say something provocative. Obamacare could help, right? I mean, if you're going to dump a bunch of retirees off the healthcare system of a school district, it's nice to be able to say, hey, but you can sign up for Obamacare instead.
Well, the retirees, you've already got Medicare kind of hanging.
Well, they're not 65 yet. I'm saying for the people between 55 and 65. Mm-hmm. Those are the ones the district's paying for, right?
Yeah. Well,
dump them on Obamacare, baby.
Yeah, there you go. No, this is an interesting thing. Part of what's interesting is why, folks aren't fighting harder to get out from under healthcare given Obamacare.
All right. Very nicely said. It's so good to have you back, Rick.
It's good to be with you, baby.
I'm just so excited. I should say, too, we are taping this late on a Tuesday afternoon, and Rick and I are enjoying a beer. How do you say this, Rick? Do you know? Leffe?
That sounds right to me.
All right. But Amber did not choose to partake, but she is here. It is now time for everyone's favorite segment, Amber's Research Minute. Amber. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Mike.
Isn't it fun to have Rick back?
So much fun.
Oof, it's like old times. Yeah.
He hasn't said anything, though, sexist or racist or anything yet. So maybe
he's
you can prod him.
Yet.
I'm an older, wiser person.
More circumspect.
Oh,
very good.
Disappointing.
Okay, but he did say something religious. Let me ask you this, Amber, as you know, as a Sunday school teacher, did you like his analogy there, like the cage busting to the sins and sinners? Don't hate the person, hate the sin, not the sinner.
Sinner. I think it's very appropriate, and I like it, and I've heard it a lot.
Hate the sin, not the sinner.
That's right.
That sounds a little squishy, if you ask me.
Hate the inaction, not the inactionist.
Okay, there you go.
Is that a word?
Good.
It could be.
Look, I see a blog post coming. Or now that you're on Twitter, you could totally tweet that.
Hate the inaction, not the inactionist?
Yes.
I shall.
Done. It's done. All right. Excellent. All right, Amber. What you got for us this week?
All right. We got lots of folks complaining legitimately that the ed reform world is overly focused on math and reading scores. I think you guys were complaining about that in the earlier part of the podcast.
Mm-hmm.
To the neglect of other important outcomes. So along comes a new paper by Colin Hitt and Julie Trivett at a University of Arkansas called Don't Know or Don't Care. Explore a potential new measure of non-cognitive ability. It's interesting stuff. So they look at survey item response rates, okay, and whether they predict educational attainment. They're using the 1997 National Longitudinal Survey of Youth, or NLSY, tracks a nationally representative sample of young adults. So these guys were born between 1980 and 1984. They're about between, 29 and 33. They're surveyed annually every year, and so they were able to compare that information from 1997 to the highest educational outcomes reported in 2010. Hmm. We get all that?
Okay.
They count the number of items left blank or answered I don't know on the survey. Hmm. And so again, this is not a cognitive survey. It's just like, you know, do you have a job? How much are you making now? Okay, just direct questions.
Hmm.
And they posit that the responses or lack thereof could mean loss of interest or lack of effort, which what they call this a measure of conscientiousness.
Mm-hmm.
They find that percentage of questions left unanswered is a significant predictor of educational attainment after controlling for a bunch of factors, including cognitive ability. The fewer the questions left unanswered, the higher the likelihood overall that respondents will enroll in college. This is exploratory research, very important to say. It needs a bunch of additional study, but it was intriguing. I thought it was creative. And, you know, I mean, if this is a new way to measure a non-cognitive skill, it's kind of promising.
So the idea here is that somebody's asked to do this survey, right? They're in and they get the survey and they're like, ugh, whatever. And they just don't care. So they don't fill out part of the survey.
I mean, that's what their hypothesis
is. And that the people that do that are less likely to graduate from college after controlling for lots of stuff and things.
Right.
No, it's interesting. I mean, it's sort of, you could call it on a positive way, you say, okay, people who fill out the survey, you know, are conscientious and diligent and responsible, good citizens. This is part of the government. You could also call them what? Like patsies, right? I mean, somebody who's like, right? I mean, why fill out this survey? I mean, you know, from a rational perspective, libertarians would say, look, there's no benefit in it. Why are you filling out the survey?
And in fact, if you're of a certain bent and you're not crazy about giving this information away to a bunch of bureaucrats.
Right. You mean you're like holed up in your Montana cabin? Is that what you're saying?
Or I mean, like, you're like, why am I going to spend, 20 minutes of my life sitting around filling out bubbles so that these people will know more about me?
This is a guy, Rick Hess, who does not vote for what he has these complicated rationales, but same kind of deal, right? Because you could be spending that time doing something else.
Well, and getting bossed around by a bunch of bureaucrats.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's interesting that, like, right, that you are considered less cognitively developed here if you don't like to spend your time doing bureaucrat bubbles.
But that is, you know, but in order to graduate from high school or graduate from college, to some degree, you've got to go along and get along.
Right.
You got to put up with all the BS,
and I mean,
right?
I'm assuming they agreed to participate in this study. There's got to be some, you know, incentive here. I don't know what it is. But.
Well, it reminds me of how, you know, the military, until very recently, has said that they don't, they will not basically look at recruits who have been schooled via online learning, you know, because they feel like if you haven't had to put up with the BS of high school, you won't be prepared to put up with the BS of the military, right? And it's interesting. And there's probably some truth to that. I mean, now it's silly in that there could be some great recruits out there who are homeschooled or whatever and deserve to be given a chance to serve in the military. But it is interesting that there is, you know, there's something to this. And again, do we call that non-cognitive skill, or do we call that, you know, just being willing to put up with a bunch of crap?
Well, that's right. So, I mean, partly to Ben Taylor, right? This is a problem with everybody loves Paul Tuff's book, and so everything's non-cognitive.
Yeah.
And the willingness to sit around and take orders, you know, Hannah Arendt would have called this the willingness to put up with the banality of evil.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure that we necessarily want to say that this is a, you know, good proxy for all these things we care about.
Well, and I think sometimes having done survey research in a prior life, I think sometimes I don't know actually means I don't know. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're told on a survey question, if you have reasonable reason to believe that someone really doesn't know the answer, you have to put that. You can't force them into a neutral. You can't, you know, just force them to answer it. So in this case, they counted a don't know as sort of an apathetic response, and it could not be apathy at all. It could
but
be
if it's,
legitimate.
You know, do you have a job? I mean, if they're, those are the questions, how do they not know?
Not all of them, but some of them are, you know, a little bit, something that you might not know, you know, like, I don't know, how old, if you're 30, how old were you making at 18? I don't know if I'd be able to answer that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, fair enough.
This is good. This is a good one, Amber.
Excellent. All right. Well, let's see. I hope there is some more research on this, because clearly, look, a lot of people are trying to chase this question about how do you study things other than academic achievement that might matter, because then we could have a more balanced accountability system. You could, you know, figure out if test scores actually are strongly correlated with these other things, then it's okay to rely on test scores so much. So this is good stuff. This is important. We will follow this going forward.
Yes.
That is all the time we've got for this week. Rick, it was great having you on the show.
Good to be on, babe.
Until next week.
I'm Rick Hess.
And I'm Mike Petrilli at the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at edexcellence.net.